John Fred Young, what a player. I mean, we're talking about some deep, deep commitment into every note he plays. It's 110% turned on when he starts playing. It's like a freaking runaway 18-wheeler that's going downhill with no brakes. Bring it on when he plays. It's absolutely exciting. And I want to share with you some of this great, great insight into John Fred Young. Is well known for his high energy, his deep groove, his dynamics, and his showmanship. His band, Black Stone Cherry, are a true band of brothers who have toured the world many times over the past 20 years, and they're still going at it stronger than ever. His family also has a deep, deep musical history as well, which we'll get into. So joining us live from Kentucky, please welcome John Fred Young. Yes.
What is going on, Dom? How you doing?
John Fred, I get such a kick out of your playing. It's so deep and so powerful. Listen, you got to learn not to hold back or you're going to get an ulcer.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Absolutely fantastic, man. Great, great fun and just so great. But, you know, you're coming to me from Kentucky here. So you grew up on a farm.
Yes, sir.
And there's some really great insight as to the real quality and morals and deep work ethic commitment that you have from being on a farm. So just go back to the early days. What was it like growing up on a farm and then music seeping into your world?
Well, I'll tell you what. First, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And obviously, thanks to Chad. Got to say thanks to him for inviting me to come on this amazing show. I grew up here in South Central Kentucky, and my dad and my uncle are two members of the Kentucky Headhunters, which Southern rock, you know, outlaw type country. There they are. That's them being their normal selves. So I would go out with my dad and uncle on the road during the summertime. And I don't ever think I knew any different because it was just my dad and uncle, you know, and I knew they played music. And I never really thought about playing drums or guitar until I was, you know, probably in middle school, you know, 13, 14 years old. But my uncle got me a little kit of drums when I was probably about two. And I used to just, there you go. It's so funny because I have three daughters, and my middle daughter, Sage, looks exactly like I do right there. And I just realized that looking at it, you know, but I used to beat the fire out of them. And, you know, as time went on, I think, you know, my mom was kind of like, hey, let's make some room in your room. You know, let's get these out of here, you know, because I was driving her crazy. And so, you know, gave them to Uncle Fred and he stored them. But as years went on, I got into music and I wanted to play drums. So I remember, this is so funny. I got into really collecting antique pocket knives, like old Case and like Fighting Roosters and stuff. And like, you know, I would go to, you know, shows and stuff like that, like knife shows. And I somehow collected like about 50 knives. So I wanted a drum set really, really bad. And so my uncle, I asked him, I said, hey, do you have a drum set that I could buy from you? And I'm about 13 years old. I'm in seventh grade. And he said, I'll sell you one. So I went up to the practice house, which is the old house that my dad and uncle and Greg and Anthony and, you know, all of them. But before the Headhunters were ever, you know, the Headhunters, they were a rock band called Itchy Brother. And so he let me go upstairs and look at some drums. And there was this Ludwig, I'll never forget. It's a Ludwig Black Oyster Pearl. It was probably like a 60s, you know, and I was like, man, this is the one right here. And he's like, I don't know about that one. You know, let's get, you know. And I was like, no, Fred, I love that one. He's like, oh man, you know. So I sold all my pocket knives and I think I got like maybe $500 together. And I took it to him. And before I could take it to him, he had the drums brought down, like downstairs at Prax house, and he cleaned them all up and stuff. And he, you know, he wouldn't take my money. So I was like, it was so great. And I still got that kit. It's up in my loft right here. But, I I started just playing, and I would go down to the practice house, which we live in South Central Kentucky, in a town called Edmonton, and a lot of farmland. I mean, there's, you know, more cows than people. And I would go down there. My mom would drive me down to my dad, and I'd sit down at the practice house all day long playing these drums. I didn't know what I was doing, you know, and Fred kind of left me, you know, alone, because he was like, I don't want to intervene, you know. And he would come up and show me stuff, and we would work on rudiments. And I remember when I was in seventh grade, I wanted to do a talent show at our school. And so I said, you know what, I'm going to take those drums. I'm going to set them up on the stage, and I'm going to do a drum solo. Well, thank goodness there's no recording of that, because it was there's no telling what it sounded like. It was just a bunch of bashing. And I remember when I got done, I won third place. I mean, I was tickled to death. But my best friend, Chris, who sings in our band, is our singer, he come up to me after we got done, and he said, man, he said, that was awesome. He said, listen, my dad's going to get me a guitar this summer. And he said, we need to put a band together. And I was like, huh? I was like, yeah. You know, his dad, great, amazing guitar player. And so he comes from a very, very his long line of musicians. His grandfather was a mandolin maker, incredible mandolin maker, and made acoustic guitars too. And so, you know, as kids, like Chris and I would go down, it's just he and I, and we would go down to the practice house. And, you know, my dad and uncle, I think they got really tickled, because they were like, oh, man, this is cool. You know, like, you know, they're teenagers and they want to play music. But we hung in there, and we got some other buddies from school that wanted to play. And, you know, it was just, the years went on, and it's like, man, we finally, that dad was just, it was at the point where dad was like, man, I think y'all are going to, like, do this, you know, is this really what y'all want to do? And we were like, yeah, yeah. So, you know, we played through high school and stuff, and we would play at the ball games, basketball games, and like it was cool. We had a lot of friends really dug what we were doing before we ever had a record deal or anything like that. We'd have our buddies come down to the practice house and hang out. I mean, you got a picture. This thing is a old house in the middle of nowhere, out in the middle of farm country. So we would stay there till 1 or 2 in the morning and just drag our butts to school the next day, be worn out, but we would be jamming all night long. So that's kind of how things got started, you know, with me and playing drums, and my dad and uncle, you know, helping us out, you know. And yeah that's well, it right there.
With those late jam sessions, how did you do in school?
Valedictorian, right? Ah. You know what's funny is, you know, I love history, and I excelled well in history and English. Math, not so much. But my granddaddy was an amazing teacher in our county here, and he taught for like 32 or 33 years. And he was a very artistic guy. He played piano, and my grandmother played piano too. So their home is right down the road from my wife and I. We built our house right here on a farm, and like the practice house is right down there, and then Nanny and Papa's house is right down there, and Uncle Fred is right up the hill. So I mean, like, it's we didn't move too far from the nest. But no, I just it was funny, because I remember my grandfather was like, he was so proud of my dad and uncle with the accomplishments they did with the Headhunters. And, you know, he was always wanting my dad and uncle to go to college. And then when we started playing music, listen, he was one of the most classy guys you'd ever meet. But he would turn around and have the greatest potty mouth you had ever met, you know. So I remember when I, you know, got out of high school, we were really, really working hard. Every single day at the practice house, we were practicing. Like I said, we'd come in late to school, and I think the teachers had all pretty much given up on us. They were like, they're going to be a rock band. So, you know, but I remember my grandfather said, now, listen, I know he said, I know you want to play this music stuff. like your dad and uncle, but he said, you need to go to college. And I said, okay, Pop, yeah, I know, I'm going to do that. So I went a semester, and I did really well, but we got some interest from a record label, and I had to go tell him, hey, look, I got to do this music stuff. And he understood, you know, and my grandma, you know, she, to be honest with you, my grandma was so into like the Headhunters, and she was so into our band. She had every single one of our shirts on hangers in her bedroom back there. So like, you know, my grandma was like, don't worry about it, honey. She said, you just go rock and roll, you know? So to be honest, you're talking about, you know, your values and where you come from, that I truly am blessed. I had the most wonderful, just, you know, family that supported us. And I think that's, I every day I have to be grateful for that, you know, because my grandparents were so supportive. We would practice until sometimes, I'm not even joking, 2 o'clock in the morning, 3, and we would walk, because we didn't have our driver's license. We would walk down the gravel road to my grandparents' house, and my grandma would be up at 2 o'clock in the morning making food, and because she knew we'd come down there and eat, and they stayed up late too. So they were just super supportive. And, you know, my dad, he produced our first record that we recorded back in 2005. So, you know, it's been a very big family, you know, experience for us. And that's one of the, you know, there he is right there. That's Richard. That's my dad.
Yeah.
Well, that was cool, man. That picture's really cool. We took that in England, and I'm, you know, my dad had this terrible fear of flying. He wouldn't get on a plane. And so I told him, I said, man, I got a buddy in England. So we started, let me back up. We started touring in England and over in Europe about 2007. Mm. And we went over with a bunch of buddies, an American band here in the States called Hinder. And they were doing great at radio and stuff. And they said, you guys want to go tour with us over there? We were like, oh my gosh. Yeah. It was their first time over and our first time. So we got, you know, got a little airport shuttle van, and we followed them around and did shows, and just kept, you know, building it. But over the years, we headlined a festival called Rambling Man. And it's so funny. I had a buddy of mine over there who's a promoter named Martin. He said, what's your dad and the Headhunters doing? Do they tour over here any? And I said, man, I can't get my dad on an airplane. And he said, let's book a tour, and we'll tell him after we book it. I said, that's a good idea. So we got that picture of he and I, is that they played with us at a festival in England. And it's so funny, like getting to have your dad and uncle and the Headhunters, you know, play on a festival that you're headlining in England. That's a very special moment for me. So that picture's at that show.
Well, that is absolutely beautiful. You know, this family connection that you have is just an absolutely beautiful story, because this really is a part of what all of life is about. When you have family and friends that close, and you're living that close, and you have that kind of relationship, it just adds so much more to the depth of the music.
Yes, sir.
The Headhunters were playing, they were doing their thing. You were young hearing them, so they must have been influential to you as far as the kind of music that they were playing. That must have been seeping into your mind at that time.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, they have made so many great records. And I, you know, I look back at, like, you know, the Headhunters actually started in 88, I believe. And they released the first record in 89. And it was crazy, you know, because, like, in country music at the time, nobody was playing rock and roll. It was more standard type country stuff. Yeah. And so the Headhunters were a rock band. I mean, always, they were huge Zeppelin fanatics, you know, the Who, Stones. And, you know, it's like, they just, like, after a while, you know, they got with, there was two brothers, the Phelps brothers from Arkansas. And, you know, it's wild how the band came together. There's a guy, Ronnie McDowell, who was a great, you know, singer, and he was touring, and Doug, the bass player for the Headhunters, he was playing bass, and Greg, who plays lead for the Headhunters, was playing guitar with Ronnie. And my dad was selling t-shirts. So that's how they kind of met. And after Itchy Brother had stopped doing that lineup, they put the Headhunters together. And, you know, they made some really great records. And it's just amazing. Like I see people on the road, and obviously like all the bands that we tour with, you know, they, like, I remember when we first started touring, they'd come up and they'd be like, "Man, is your dad and uncle the Headhunters?" You know, and there's Fred at the Grammys. They won a Grammy in 1990 for Best New Group. I think that's what it is. But yeah, I mean, they just made some killer albums. And I'll tell you honestly, one of my favorite albums they ever made was called "That'll Work," and it was with Johnny Johnson, who obviously was Chuck Berry's piano player, but really, Chuck was in Johnny's band, right? But, I remember being a kid, and somehow my dad and the guys got hooked up with Johnny. I can't remember how, but they did a record together, and it is one of the best records. It came out on Elektra in 1993, I believe, and man, I just remember being a kid, and Johnny Johnson was down here at the practice house, you know, playing. I mean, he's, you know, just godfather of rock and roll, right? So, but I remember my dad being like, you know, we could stop touring right now, and if this was the last thing we did, this is the pinnacle, you know? But I remember being a kid watching him play piano, and I didn't understand what the magnitude of who I was in the room with at that time, you know, being 9 or 10 years old, but, yeah, they've done a lot of really cool stuff, man. They've put out great albums, and they still tour. I mean, they're still out there doing it.
It really is incredible that, you know, having won the Grammy and, you know, 30 years later, they are still at the cusp of making it happen. That really is extremely inspiring. Yeah. So who were some of the drummers that you were listening to that were inspiring you, that were influencing your sound and your playing?
Well, you know, when obviously when I grew up, Fred was my, you know, number one, and always will be. But, you know, it's wild because Fred has a super eclectic taste of music and drummers. So I remember as a kid, like we would sit at the practice house and he would say, "Okay, we're going to work on Rudiments." Right. But he would dig out CDs and play me stuff, like just wild, random stuff, man. And I think, one, obviously Zeppelin, like John Bonham, he introduced me to, you know, John Bonham and Led Zeppelin. And I mean, how can you not fall in love with John Bonham? That was like, you know, when I think the first time I ever heard Zeppelin was at the practice house. And, you know, I was like kind of blown away. And Fred was, you know, trying to teach me how to play this stuff. And so John Bonham's been one of my favorite drummers, you know. And then Bernard Purdy. Fred was a massive Bernard Purdy fan. So, you know, he told me, he was like, "Look, man, we got to." Okay, so this picture right here is really cool. This is at John Bonham's grave in England. And I have a very dear friend of mine. His name's Connor. And he actually lives about 5 miles from the church and the gravesite. And I remember, you know, man, when I was in high school, our singer Chris printed me out a picture of his gravestone. I lived and breathed John Bonham every day, you know, trying to play those things he played and trying to, you know, cop those things. And he printed me out a picture of that gravesite, and I stuck it up in my room. And I said, "Man, I'd love to go there someday and pay my respects to his gravesite." And I remember in 2000, that was 2013, and my buddy Connor said, he said, "Have you ever," he knew how big a fan I was of Bonham, and he said, "Have you ever been to his gravesite?" And I said, "No." I said, "You know, I know it's here somewhere." He said, "Yeah, it's about 5 miles from my house." Well, I was like, "Oh," you know, and so we go there. His dad drove us down the road, and it was really, I got there, and you know, man, it was emotional.
Yeah.
It was really emotional for me. I think just because, like, I grew up as a kid, like, watching everything I could of him. Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Yeah. But, yeah, it just, God, it just cut music. That's what music does.
It really, it's powerful. And the fact that you get that emotional, I mean, which many of us do regarding John Bonham. He left us way too soon and gave us some great music. And you mentioned John Bonham and Bernard Purdy, who were two of the favorite drummers of a dear friend of mine, Jeff Porcaro.
Oh, dude, that's on another level.
And Jeff was highly influenced by Bonham and Bernard Purdy. And you can hear that sound, even in Jeff's own style, you can hear those influences of that sound. And I got to tell you something, you know, watching you play and hearing you play, you really have that Bonham edge in your playing where every freaking note that you hit is committed 110%. That is so huge.
That means the world. I really appreciate that, Dom. Thank you.
That's fantastic.
I still don't know what the hell I'm doing, but I just hit them. So,
well, let's talk about that. When you got together with Uncle Fred, you know, he was showing you rudiments and showing you stuff. What was he teaching you?
So, paradiddle, number one. He was like, I remember even being a kid who was like, okay, look, you gotta do right, left, right, right. And we would sit there, and I don't know. I it's my favorite rudiment of all time. I mean, and there's so many great ones. And, you know, but, you know, Fred, he'll tell me stories, and he, you know, bless his heart, he is one of the best drummers in my opinion, in the world. And, but, you know, he tells me, he's like, man, like, I'll play something for him now. We'll be hanging out up here at my house or something. I'll get the pad, you know. And he's like, let me branch off really quick. So Fred is, like, always on YouTube. He's always looking at, like, different, you know, drummers, and he'll send me something. Hey, he's like, check this out, you know. And YouTube has turned us into, you know, a bunch of, you know, hermits, because all we want to do is sit and watch it. But I know, okay, so I never met Gavin Harrison, but I want to. Fred is, like, become a big fan of his, and the stuff he did, there's one, and I mean, everybody's probably seen it. It's the Drumeo thing where he's doing, it's like, I can't even remember what he calls this beat, but he's doing, like, it's just bizarre. And it's like, you know, oh, hardest drum beat to learn in the world. And I remember Fred sent it to me. He goes, man, he goes, he's really country, even more than I am. He goes, man, what the heck's he doing on this? And I said, but I don't know, man. I don't know. I listen to it. And it's like, it's crazy because his feet are doing 16s, but he's playing the triplet. And then his hands are in 5, if that makes sense. And it's like, it is bizarre. It's so, like, hard to separate and understand how he lays the accents and stuff. But I don't know. You guys might know what that video is. But, man, that he is such a great drummer. But Fred and I, we find these drummers and send them to each other now. Like, I turned him on to Thomas Lang and Thomas Pridgen, who I think those two guys were just, you know, insane players, great, great drummers. And, you know, but growing up, like, Fred, you know, turned me on John Bonham, Ian Pace, you know, what I'll tell you. Okay. So one of the drummers that I liked a lot when I was growing up was Joe Morello. And we had the Hot Licks VHS tape. Fred had it, and we would play that thing and watch, and, like, you know, dude, just, I mean, on another planet, you know?
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. Joe Morello was one of my teachers that I studied with in the early 1970s. Joe lived in New Jersey. I live here on Long Island, so it was not that far a drive to get there. And I met Joe backstage at a Buddy Rich concert. And I just, you know, was also one of those that were in awe of his playing. And to have the many years, about 8 years of going back and forth, taking lessons with Joe, it was an eye-opener. And John Bonham's two favorite drummers were Buddy Rich and Joe Morello.
Yeah.
So when you think about the influence of what these guys have done, you know, Bonham was a great jazz drummer. And a lot of people don't realize that. He played jazz fantastic. And that jazz influence, John was able to bring into his rock and blues style of playing. And it was just so great to I think that's a part of the brilliance of John Bonham. He was able to pull from different styles of music and have such an open mind and bring it into his playing. But a guy like Morello, you know, pops up in all these different, his name comes up all the time. So incredible. So this influence of drummers, you were bringing influences from all over the place.
Yeah, and I have to thank Fred for that because, you know, obviously, I mean, I wouldn't have grown up knowing any of those guys, you know, and so I owe a lot to him. But Fred was really influenced by Bonham, of course, and then Joe Morello. And, man, like, it's crazy watching. Like, I watched something, like, a while back of this was really cool. So Joe was on, I think it was Conan. And this was probably, you know, in the 90s. Or maybe even, I don't know, when it had to be early 90s or something, but he's playing and he's just, it's insane what he's doing. But he loses a stick and he starts grabbing at his stick bag and he pulls out like a, just like a bass drum, like mallet, you know, and he's like, what's that? No, what's this? He keeps grabbing for stick. The whole time, he's just doing like stuff with one hand that nobody can do. And I thought that's so neat and cool. But man, we would sit around, like Fred introduced me. He made me watch Buddy Rich, Gene Krupa, Max Roach, Joe Morello, just the greats, you know. And then I remember being a kid too, and the Headhunters did a really cool show called Blues Aid in Helena, Arkansas. And they obviously hugely influenced by the blues. And I remember it was the Headhunters and it was Buddy Miles. And I was like 12 or 13. And I got to watch Buddy Miles play, and him and Fred like set up two drum sets and played, and like it was just bizarre. And that, you know, he was a monster player. So definitely, I liked all the stuff Buddy Miles did. And I'm just trying to think of so many others. Like, I mean, there's countless. Fred is a big Terry Bozzio fan, and Ian Paice fan. He turned, you know. I mean, I was so lucky to have Fred to turn me on to so many great drummers. And, you know, it was cool. I'll tell you a funny story. So, I was like, I think I was probably about 13 or 14. And I went to, with my dad to Nashville, and it was the summer NAMM show. And I'm walking around and I'm looking, like, it's the first time I'd ever been, you know, to any kind of show like that with that many drums. I was just like geeking out, freaking, you know, I'm like, wow, these drums. But I remember, you know, being like a teenager, you know, you go and like, you know, you're looking at all the drums and like you're wanting to play them all, and you know, all the companies are like, okay, move along. You know, get out of here, kid. Well, I remember I walked by this group of people, and there was a gentleman playing a practice pad, and there was probably about 10 or 15 people watching this guy. And I was like, man, what, like, this is awesome what he's doing, you know? And so I sit there, and then people started moving in and out, and I kind of like wedged up in there, you know? And I remember I knew this guy was like outer space good. So I was like, I'm just going to watch him. And he was playing and he had his sticks, and he said, now, and there was a guy in front of me, he said, now I'm gonna play, and I want you to take that stick out of my hand, see how light I'm holding it. And I thought it was so bizarre, this guy grabbed the stick out of this gentleman's hand when he's playing it. And you know, he was expressing to have a loose grip and not to choke the sticks. And it was like one of the, I didn't know at the time how important this would be, but the gentleman worked with me on how to hold sticks and how to get this motion that did this. And I was like, you know, I was like, man, this guy really, and he did, he sat there for like 30 minutes with me. And there's probably four of us left by the time I said bye to him. Such a nice guy. But that was Jim Chapin. Right. And I remember going back to my uncle when I got home from Nashville. I said, man, I really, you know, got to like meet this guy, and he's, what was his name? I told him, he's like, you what? He was freaking out, you know? And I was like, yeah, he showed me how to do this thing called Moeller. And so Fred was just like, you have no clue, you know? And, but no, I obviously took that with me too. And Like, I try, you know. It's kind of a thing, man. Like, I'm so glad I got to spend the short amount of time I did with him and figure out, you know. He and what was so kind is he took the time, a little kid, you know, and he took the time to work with me and so many other people around there. And I've always remembered that moment.
Jim was a special person. He lived here on Long Island. And I knew Jim, and also Jim was one of my teachers for many, many years. And Jim was just, he was the last living student of Sanford Moeller. So he really understood this movement of how Moeller talked about this whipping motion. And that relaxed movement was one of Jim's things that he always taught. All the times in the lessons, he would ask me to pull the stick out of his hand, and I never had a challenge. It came out of his hand, no matter how fast or how powerful he was playing. That stick came out. So the fact that you were exposed to that is absolutely incredible. But now bring me up to about 2001. You're in your teens, and you start with the band Blackstone Cherry. You meet some friends, and here you are now forming your own band. How did that begin?
So you know, we all went to high school with each other, and Chris and I, our singer, actually went to kindergarten with each other. So we've known each other, you know. Chris is on the very far right there, and that's Ben in the middle. Ben lived in the next county over from us in Barron County. And, you know, it was just like, man, instant brothers. As soon as we put the band together at the practice house, we had some buddies. We had a party one night, you know, and a bunch of people from, you know, different schools came down, and Ben came down. And the next day, we put the band together. You know, we were having a jam part, you know, session. A lot of people were playing, and I remember Chris, it was his 16th birthday. It was June 4th, 2001, and so we went to the practice house, and we all just started jamming, and that day we put the band together, and I remember we didn't have a band name, so Ben was spending the night with me at my parents' house. You know, we're like, you know, maybe 15, 16 years old, and we had snuck and got some cigars from somebody, and they were Blackstone cigars, and we were, you know, hiding and being cool. And so we're like, what are we going to name our band, you know? And we were just, you know, the names were, you know, monumentally horrible, but he's like, hey, what if we called it like Blackstone, but the cigars were cherry flavored. He said, what if we put all that together? Blackstone Cherry. I was like, man, that's it, dude. You know, it's going to look good in lights. So, man. From that day right there, it was all of us, man. And we've been together 20 years this year. It's 20th anniversary of the band. So
absolutely fantastic. So you guys started writing. How was the writing happening? How did that? And what was some of the goals? Your writing? Did you have plans of what you wanted to do with the band, or were you just having fun?
You know, I think. With us, it's so wild because we didn't want to do anything else besides play music. And from day one, we started writing original music. I remember we wrote a song that day, and that song later got on one of our later albums. But it's just, I think it was so strange for four kids from Kentucky, very, you know, just small town, and like to have like lightning strike twice, the Headhunters and then us. I don't think we wanted to do anything else. We just wanted to play music. And I remember we would go do shows anywhere we could. We would we were playing like the country line dance places. We would ask if we could, you know, do a rock and roll night on Friday nights. And that was like, that was taboo. You know, they were like, I don't know, guys. You know, we do Boots Scoot Boogie over here on the weekends. You know, we're like, oh, listen, Friday night, just give us one night, you know? So there's this big place called The Factory in KC, Kentucky. And we would go over there, and on Fridays, we would have like local bands from the area would all play and stuff. So we started getting a little following around here. And I think my dad, there was a point in time where my dad was like, okay, you guys are actually going to do this serious, right? So he started, you know, managing us and helping us put shows together, and we would go play, you know, bike rallies. We'd go play, like, we played our Mexican restaurant here in town. Our great friends let us like play in the middle, you know, one night, and just anywhere we could. And we would, we played with so many bands in the early years, like 2002, 2003, 2004. We were playing with Ted Nugent, Grand Funk Railroad, Anthrax, the Headhunters, anybody, just random. You know, we would take a show with anybody just to get out and get exposure. And I remember in 2004, we met a guy from a label, and he really liked us, and he thought that, you know, there was something there. And so here, my dad started working together, and I gotta thank our great friends in Shinedown, because we just did a show with them the other night. Love those guys. They actually helped. It was their label they were on. It was their radio rep who found out about us, and they gave him a CD. And so he got in touch with us, and him and my dad worked for probably 2 years, and we finally got to New York and did the big showcase, you know. And it was like, man, they were just like, no. So we were like, okay, back to the drawing board. So we came back to Prax House, but we hung in there, man. We you know, finally got a deal in 2005. We went back to New York, and we signed with Roadrunner Records back in 2005, and you know, we put out some great records on that label. And then in 2014, we were free agents in the world. Yeah, that, so this right here, that's our debut record that came out in 2006. And so I think there was four or five records on that label. That's the second record, Folklore and Superstition, that came out in 2008. And worked with a really great guy, Bob Marlette, on that record. And yeah, it's crazy. Now we're on a label called Mascot out of Holland, and we're three albums deep. And our latest record is called The Human Condition, and it just came out last October. So
how prolific is the writing? In other words, who does the writing in the band? Is it a collaborative thing? Do individuals bring in songs? How do you, because I mean, you went from a young jam band in a farmhouse to being signed. I mean, this is really incredible.
It is amazing, and I think as far as the writing, so my dad is a really great songwriter, and I remember day one of us being in the practice house, you know, when we were writing original stuff, he said, you know, he explained to us how important writing was, and how, you know, we needed to hone our craft and really, you know, make this the ultimate goal. Because he said, you know, you obviously got to have a great live show. You got to be entertaining. But he said, at the end of the day, it's about the song, you know, and you all can be great musicians. You strive for that. But he said, you know, you definitely got to put that emphasis and hard work into becoming songwriters. So we all wrote the songs together, the music, the lyrics, the ideas. Like, somebody would bring in like a guitar riff, and then we would go from there. You know, one of us might have a melody, you know, pecking out something on the piano. It was very random, but we worked as a unit, you know, and that's how we do it today. You know, of course, back then we weren't touring, so we would get together at the practice house and just write for hours and hours. And my dad would come and help us how to structure, you know, verses into choruses. And, you know, we were blessed, really, really blessed, because he helped us understand the transitions, you know.
Right. So how did you work the business side now? You guys all were equal partners in this, and were you all sharing in the publishing of the tunes themselves too?
Yep, 100%. My dad told us, he was like, look, he's like, you got to do everything equal. He's like, you're a band, you're a unit, you're brothers. He said, this is why it's so important. And I like, when younger bands, you know, anybody that comes to our shows and they're, you know, enjoying what we do and they're trying to also play music, you know, we always tell them it's important to be just in a band with people you love, first of all. I mean, you gotta love the people you're playing music with, because it's a family. And so the business side of things, my dad was hugely instrumental, because he had this legacy with the Headhunters, and he knew pitfalls, and he knew what to do. And you know, and obviously the industry is changing all the time. Of course, now we're in the digital age, but, you know, Yeah, we were so lucky because he taught us about publishing, taught us about songwriting, how those things work and how the splits are. But yes, it's very, and I would tell any, you know, artist band out there is to, you know, play in a band that, you know, first of all, you got to love the music you're doing. You got to love the people and then create something that you feel proud of because, you know, and you know, I grew up wanting to, you know, be Uncle Fred or be John Bonham, but you know, you find, after I think what you're interested in you musically and what you're drawn to, those are your influences. But then after years and years, you do mold into what it is you do. And to be honest, I never ever looked at like my playing personally and defined it as what it is, because I don't know what it is, because it's just a big melting pot of guys that were light years ahead of me, and I just took it all and took little bits and pieces and I do what I do back there. And as a songwriter too, you pull from all the greats, right? You know, I mean, and I think that our brand of music, I think, strikes a chord with people and they like it because it's genuine, but it also has very it's reminiscent of you know, the Zeppelin stuff and Skinner and Aerosmith and ZZ Top and the classic iconic rock stuff.
Yeah.
Then also there's the blues influence, you know, the Muddy and Howlin' Wolf and Lightnin' Hopkins and stuff like that you know, we got introduced to from the Headhunters. And then there's some, you know, all the Motown stuff, you know, I mean, like one of my favorite, I got to see, I was really lucky, man. I got to see Percy Sledge sing in Bowling Green, Kentucky with my wife back in 2008. And you know, he's doing like When a Man Loves a Woman. I'm just sitting there like my head down, you know, like, I mean, there's probably 100 people out there watching him. I'm just like mind blown. But I loved like Sam Cooke and Percy and Otis Redding. I used to drive around in my little SUV, man. And I put like that Otis CD in and Percy Sledge and like Sam Cooke. And as a singer, I'm not a great one, but those are my, you know, guys like that. For
it's kind of interesting because, you know, it sounds like you got some serious Muscle Shoals influence from that whole world of that, you know, Southern rock and what they did with the blues and that mixture of what it was. But you mentioned singing. Listen, you do some singing. How is that learning how to sing and, you know, working on that? That's a whole nother level of adding to the complication of playing drums. What was that? What's that like?
Well, I'll tell you what. When we first started touring, all of us in the band sang, you know, backup. And we did harmonies. And Chris had, when we first put the band together, Chris had the most unique voice out of all of us. I mean, it was just power, you know, and he had this is pretty funny. So Chris has this really unique and very, very individual thumbprint of vibrato. And we kind of, like, after years and years, we've kind of come to this conclusion of why he has it. When we were kids, we had an old Wurlitzer at the practice house, and it was the one Johnny Johnson played on the Headhunters records. But my dad would work with us on singing, you know, don't sing sharp and flat, you know. Well, you know the old Peterson strobe tuners that, you know, guitar. Okay, well, my dad would hook up a microphone into that tuner, and we would set it on the Wurlitzer, and we would all get around it and, like, sing scales and stuff, you know. Well, my dad worked with Chris so much with this Wurlitzer. Now, I know this sounds crazy, but the vibrato was turned up all wide open on it. So Chris would hit a note and he would sing in it, and he would see where that strobe tuner was, you know, reacting and hold it, you know, pitch. But we think he was mimicking the Wurlitzer with the vibrato, you know, after so many years working with it. And we're like, man, listen, if we had turned that vibrato off, you know, maybe he wouldn't have the vibrato. Isn't that wild though? But
that's fantastic. So talk about, you know, in the writing process, are you guys, You know, are you jamming together when you go to the studio? What's the recording process when you get there? Do you pretty much know what you're going to do? Does the band play together? Do you go in there individually? What's that process like?
So in the early years, we recorded here in town in Glasgow, where Ben lives. There's a great guy, David Barrett, great friend of ours, who we did the first record at his studio. And, you know, first record, I mean, now let me take a step back. In high school, the very first recording we ever did is on a record called Rock and Roll Tape. And it had a piece of duct tape across the label and it had, you know, Rock and Roll and Sharpie. So we did that with David. Sold that around school and stuff. And, you know, you couldn't even get anybody to buy it for $10. And now it's on eBay. It's like, I can't afford to buy one. But the first record, the debut record we did in 2006, we did with David at his studio. And I remember we all recorded live in the room. So it was drums, bass, guitar. And what we would do is we would get the best performance we possibly could. And then if we needed to go back and retrack, you know, like a guitar part or punch in a drum fill, that's kind of how our method was for years. And we did that on Folklore and Between the Devil and the Deep Blue Sea, and also Magic Mountain, I'm pretty sure. But I'll tell you, on this last record, The Human Condition, we did a total different approach to how we recorded. And I was kind of like, you know, nervous about it first. And I got to say, we met a really great friend of ours. His name's Jordan Westfall, and he is a world-class engineer, a great, great guy. Great. We met him with some really good buddies of ours, Shaman's Harvest and Rock Band. And he came out to do some monitors for us, and he was you know, playing some stuff in the back lounge. And we were like, man, what are you listening to? And he's like, oh, I'm mixing this for this band back in Kansas City. And we're like, well, let's hear it, man, you know? So it was, I think it was like a metal record he was doing. And we were just blown away. We were like, man, you know, you recorded this and engineered it, mixed it? And he said, yeah. We were like, all right, okay, cool. Well, so when it came time to do this last record, we asked Jordan if he would, be our engineer. And it was cool, man, because he brought a lot of his thoughts and ideas on how to get sounds. And he's just world class, man. The wild thing is that we actually recorded for the first time one guitar track as a scratch and then another guitar and bass, and Chris would do a scratch vocal. I would go in on this record and do the drums last. So I was, and that's the green DW kit. It's a maple kit. And actually, what's crazy, that kit right there is what I'm touring with live, but that's not the kit we recorded on the record. I called Garrison at DW and I said, hey man, I said, we're gonna do things a little different on this record. And I'd like to have a kit that is really unique and doesn't sound like any, you know, it's just, it doesn't have to be like from outer space, but something that's a little bit different than my maple kits. And he's like, you want something like loud? And I'm like, yeah, man. He said, man, I got this oak kit, solid oak kit. He said, it weighs a ton. He said, it's the prototype. But when we first started making these, you know, kits, we had to make one and test it out. And he sent me a picture of it, and I said, yeah, I'll take that. And so that's what I use now. I will say it's a 23-inch bass drum. So it's a 23 by 16 D. Mm-hmm. It's a – and this is what we use on the record. It is a 13, 16, 18 tom. And I used a bunch of different wild snare drums. I got some snare drums back here I use on the record. But I was just trying to get a drum sound that was really unique. And I think I'm just trying to see what, if anything's back here. I've got, like, you know, I obviously love the DW stuff. I've been with them for 12 years and I've collected antique stuff, and yeah, I got like the Fred Blood, you know what I mean? So But that record was wild because we first time we'd ever recorded drums last. And to be honest with you, like when Jordan mentioned it, I was like, man, I'm kind of like freaked out about that because we've always done the live take and then we go back and fix guitars and fix drum takes. But he was like, well, he's like, let's try it and see how you like it. And what I found out is really cool this helped me out a lot too, is when I'm doing the drums last, everybody is sitting in the control room and they're really listening to every single thing I'm doing. And I think when we're playing live, when we're cutting, you know, live tracks, everybody's in their own world playing an instrument. And I really value everybody's thoughts and, you know, ideas when it comes to the drum parts. Like, you know, Chris won't tell you, but he's a really good drummer too, our singer. And, you know, he'll come up with different, you know, ideas and beats, and Ben will too. And so it's a team, man. Like there's parts on Chris's like lead solos, you know, I'm like, hey Chris, man, like I'll hum a melody and he'll like, all right, let me work that in there. So we just work back and forth with each other on stuff, and it's a team, you know?
It's beautiful. Well, it's amazing. The sound you guys get both in the studio and live is just so unique. And again, so powerful. It's like a wall of sound. But I know in your hands, you've got the Vader 55AA. How do you like that model stick in your hands? Because it works for you, right?
I'll tell you what. So I love the 55AA, and I'll tell you why. So when I was a kid, Fred played just standard 5A. And I remember, you know, growing up, man, you know, he would give me sticks and stuff, and I'd play with him. But I always felt like, look at that guy. When I called Chad back in 2011, I said, hey man, I'm John Fred. I play in a band, you know? And, I was like, man, I really go through sticks a lot, you know? And I, you know, obviously hit hard and stuff. And I said, I got some of your old stuff, from another buddy we were touring with. And I just, man, I love them, man. They feel just the quality of the sticks and I was just impressed of how they held up, you know? So he put me in touch with Chad, and man, it was just no looking back. I mean, I went through so many different models. There was a Warrior that I used. There was the XD5A, which is longer, and everything has been great, you know? But right now I'm on the 55AAs, and I love them. It's kind of it's not like an acorn tip, but it kind of is in a way. It's more of an acorn, I suppose. But, you know, the diameter is great because it's bigger than it's bigger than a 5A, but I don't feel like it's so thick as a 5B, right? So, yeah, they've been great to me, man. I tell you, I so lucky to be with the Vader family, and I, you know, they treat me just great. You know, and I wear Chad out constantly. I went through. Chad could probably give you the correct amount. I ordered like two cases, like 12 bricks, and I went through them, I think in like 3 weeks. And you know, he's just like, "Oh yeah, just cut down more trees for you."
Well, listen,
but hold up.
Don't be surprised if we don't travel over to the farm and borrow a couple of trees you have on the farm. So that might be the next step.
We might have to start doing that.
Well, I'll tell you, John, it's John Fred, man. You are an energized person. You've got some great, great stories. You've got a great history of this band that's going on. You've got an incredible story of, you know, history from not only the farm history and in growing up on a farm with those great, great values to, of course, having your dad and your uncle to be there and influencing you, and you carry on the tradition of the music in your family, and you're inspiring hundreds of thousands of people, you know, through your music and through your live tour. So I want the band to get back on the road and get back in action sooner than later, for sure.
Thank you so much, Dom. I really appreciate that. And it's, I tell you, it's an honor to be able to talk with you today. I hope that, you know, in the future that we can meet in person and hang out and you can teach me some stuff. Cause I'm telling you, you are a master, man.
Come by, we'll get you in the studio here. We'll have some fun for sure. And I look forward when if the band at all gets into the New York area, you make sure you give me a call and track me down. I want you to be safe. Send my best to your dad and your uncle, your entire family. Stay well. Keep the band going strong. You're really making a difference, and this is fantastic. Stay well, stay healthy. On behalf of the Vader Company, we thank you so much. Keep going. John Fred Young, you're fantastic.
You too, Dom. Thank you. God bless you. Take care of yourself, okay? Thank you.
Thanks so much.
See you, buddy. Till next time.
For sure. But what a great guy. I mean, the stories are endless, as you can hear. We've had people that have come on here from, my gosh, Claude Hoffman from Belgium, Rene Barthen from the Netherlands. We've got people from all around the country here. And this is just so incredible. This band has such an incredible influence. We've got, we even had Jose Gonzalez from, listen, Fort Knox, Kentucky. You're right there. You got to, at some point, Jose, get together with John Fred and hang out. You guys are close together, man. Absolutely great, great stuff. You all have been great. The Vader Company, thank you so much. Hang out. Next week, we'll do it again, and we'll have some more fun. On behalf of Alan Vader and Chad Brandolini from the Vader Company, we thank you all very much for joining us. Stay well. I'm Dom Famularo. We'll see you real soon. Thanks. Bye-bye.